Welcome to the Lancet Psychiatry Podcast. I'm Dustin Graham, senior editor based in the journal's New York City office. And today I'm joined by Dr. Christine Moutier, chief medical officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Dustin. Thanks for having me on.
So to get right into it, this past June, the organization AFSP teamed up with several other organizations, including the Kennedy Forum and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, to launch the Mental Health for Us campaign, really with the goal of getting political candidates, especially those running for president in 2020, to put mental health at the top of the ticket. With all the things that are facing Americans and climate change, economic inequalities, why should political candidates put mental health at the top of their ticket?
You know, I think we've been realizing as stigma goes down that the data really speaks for itself. At any given time, including currently right now, one in five Americans is suffering from a mental health condition. And yet the dialogue about mental health and how to recognize the signs and symptoms in yourself, in a loved one, how to access treatment, how to support a loved one, we haven't understood that. And I think stigma has kept things really deeply quiet, basically in the dark, for people to be suffering on their own. And that is changing. Over the last, I'd say, 5 to 6 years, people with their own experiences of a mental health condition, as well as, by the way, in the suicide prevention movement, people who've experienced their own suicidal struggles are coming out and speaking out loudly. And these are panels that we at AFSP host at the White House, in front of Congress people and other policymakers, so that they can understand that these conversations are important to have. And by the way, in any setting where we are, it connects with people's own experiences because these are such common experiences. It's a rare family that does not have an experience with either, you know, some type of mental health condition and a loved one suffering, or an addiction or substance use issues. So, you know, I think the enormity of the prevalence rates, as well as the impact on individuals, families, and the American sort of economy and workplaces and society in general, we're now realizing all of that. So it would feel very strange for candidates not to be addressing something that is so pivotal in Americans' lives.
So we do know, I mean, there's obviously still quite a bit there's always more to learn about mental illness and mental health disorders, but we do know quite a bit, and we do have some idea of things that work to help fight and combat mental illness and mental health disorders. One of the challenges for politicians and for candidates is to take that information and distill it into a clear, concise message. You know, what are your thoughts on that? You know, how can a campaign like Mental Health for Us, where you're sort of bringing these stories to light and you're providing candidates and politicians with this information, how do they distill it down into a clear message that they can get across to voters?
I think that is actually one of the upsides of this Mental Health for Us initiative, is that we have actually provided very distilled talking points for anyone who wants to start speaking about these issues, whether they themselves have personal experience with them or not. You know, some of the main points are the prevalence of mental health conditions, the impact on individuals and families, and the economic toll in our nation, which is enormous. It's $444 billion per year, according to the National Institutes of Mental Health. But also that there are treatments that are available that have been developed and proven effective, but are not always accessible in many communities. I think it's both a lack of knowledge, but it's also an issue of actual mental health parity. So I think for candidates, their discussion can be around educating the public about what these health issues are, how prevalent they are, and that there are effective treatments, and part of their work will be to make them more accessible to the public. There are other sort of public health initiatives that are also very, very important, including continued and actually increased funding of research related to mental health conditions and treatments, as well as for suicide prevention efforts and research into that. Also, a public health initiative must address the universal education of all citizens, and that can really start in K-12 in terms of education about mental health.
You mentioned access, and that's probably going to be one of the key topics coming up in the debates, and not just for presidential office, but for, you know, Senate, Congress, is healthcare. and health insurance and access. What role do you see, you know, a campaign like Mental Health for Us helping to spread that message that we need universal access? What positions do your organization, the Mental Health for Us campaign, sort of take on that?
Well, I think the most important thing that Mental Health for Us will provide for candidates is the priority and the importance that needs to be proclaimed and then acted on in a sustained way over time. So that would be the first thing, just simply that level of understanding and priority and follow through. You know, I think the other pieces to it will then be in the details of how does every American citizen have access to mental health care, including addiction care, and not just urgent care in an emergency department setting, but effective interventions that most oftentimes need to be sustained over a period of time, usually weeks to months, and then a recovery phase where their wellness can be maintained. And that can include both the scaling up of effective interventions. It also has significant ramifications for the workforce of mental health clinicians, which currently is too sparse in our nation and poorly distributed as well, especially in rural areas. It also can include the use and the training of peer support. Trained specialists in peer support are people who've experienced mental health struggles themselves, who then play a key role in a variety of clinical settings to carry out the clinical care that really serves to augment the use of clinical treatments.
It does seem like a good point that mental health care fits really well within the general debate about, you know, access and general health.
Oh, yes, yes, most certainly. Many physical health conditions also need to get a higher priority, but because pretty much the entire arena of mental health had been so shrouded in stigma, the level of priority and sort of spotlighting it as a much needed and important health resource for Americans, it simply cannot be overstated.
Getting a little bit more into the stigmatizing of mental illness, it's a little difficult to ignore. The past weekend, we saw two mass shooting tragedies, one in Texas, one in Ohio. Chicago had its worst weekend of gun violence. And I guess the way that I want to frame this is, so on the one hand, politicians, policymakers aren't talking enough about mental illness, but then in some cases, they'll talk about it in a way that is inaccurate or misrepresents mental illness and mental health disorders. So with the case of gun violence, the scientific data overwhelmingly shows that America's gun violence problem is a public health problem driven by access to firearms. But you do have some leadership, Republican leadership, the president just this weekend, basically blaming it on mental health. So how can candidates, how can we, the media, how can Mental Health for Us campaigns, your organization, how can we combat misinformation to make sure we don't further stigmatize mental health when it comes to, you know, topics like gun control and gun violence?
Right. The fact that mental health conditions are so prevalent and so profoundly impact Americans' lives is a standalone fact that must continue to be discussed and solutions promoted and sustained. The topic of gun violence, which, as you well point out, has been being erroneously linked, overly linked, to the problems of people with mental illness, can be debunked by understanding, I'd say, two facts. The first is that in a very thorough analysis of the totality of violent acts in the United States, a very thorough sort of dissection of all of the upstream factors that were thought to be sort of root cause drivers of violent behavior were examined. And of all of those factors, less than 5% of violent acts could be attributed to mental illness. So there's one sort of delinking piece of data. And the other is just more of a secondary piece of knowledge, which is that people with mental health conditions are much more likely to be the victims of abuse or violence than they are to perpetrate violence. So, you know, I think to me, what has happened is that there's been an assumption that anyone who would commit such a violent act as either an intimate partner type of violent act or a mass shooting type of act, it must stem from a sort of disturbance in their mind that leads to those acts. And most certainly, people who commit violent acts have all sorts of different problems in their life. Most of those problems relate to criminal behaviors and to some extent substance use, but there is less overlap between, for example, people who commit homicide than people who die by suicide, than there are factors in common. It's a very actually complicated topic, but the facts that I've laid out are not complicated. Those are the ones that are very clear that can, I think, help people to understand that just because it's an unfathomable act does not mean that it's attributable to a treatable mental health condition.
That's sort of the message, that distilling all that information into just kind of a clear message that, yes, while, you know, gun violence shouldn't be blamed on, or and it's not predicted by mental illness or mental health disorders, that really the issue should be about what's actually driving in. The scientific evidence just does not point towards a mental illness.
Now, that said, ever since the Virginia Tech shooting many years ago on that college campus, the FBI's analysis of communication that occurred around that particular individual at Virginia Tech showed that numerous people observed, like something about around 100 staff and other students had observed disturbed and concerning behaviors exhibited by that student. Mm-hmm. And the communication web looked like a very chaotic, you know, lines leading to nowhere kind of communications. And so since that time, there have certainly been important efforts on college campuses and workplaces that are considered threat assessment efforts that look for signs of disturbed behavior. Now, some of them lump disturbed and distressed, which I think has further, in a way, led to the conflation between mental health suffering and the propensity to commit a violent act towards others. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just to say that those threat assessment efforts are very, very important, and there can be behavioral warning signs for people who go on to commit violent acts. But again, assuming that those are always driven by a treatable mental health condition is simply incorrect.
Getting, I guess, more into your organization's focus, AFSP's focus, when tragedies like this happen, rightfully so, they make the headlines, and then unfortunately we have this predictable pattern of things kind of go down for a while and then another tragedy happens. But in between, there is this constant high rate of not only gun violence, but also firearm-related suicides. So suicide in particular is a sensitive and difficult topic within mental health to discuss, I think, for a lot of politicians. So I wanted to get your thoughts on specifically on suicide and suicide prevention. What are the ways you think we're failing in discussing it both in the media and also politicians and political debates? And how would you hope candidates would learn and take what AFSP is doing and what Mental Health for Us is doing to learn from those mistakes and to take the information that you're providing to sort of shape that message around suicide and suicide prevention?
Well, I actually do think that the national dialogue on the topic of suicide and suicide prevention is improving, and we see some indicators of that in national media. Certainly, politicians increasingly are getting involved and promoting legislation that shows evidence to be able to prevent suicide. My personal take on it is that the data around veteran suicide, veterans have a higher rate of suicide than their age-matched civilian cohort population, about 1.5 times the risk. As tragic as that is, it helped, I think, policymakers to recognize suicide as a public health problem and something that was not just a fringe topic that couldn't be spoken of, but rather was something that needed to be spoken of. I think teen suicide, while the rate of teen suicide is actually much, much lower than that of middle age and older age Americans, the issue of the loss of life, especially at a young age, to a potentially preventable cause of death, such as suicide. An aside, suicide leads to more youth deaths than all other medical conditions put together and is the second leading cause of death in Americans aged 10 to 34. I think those two populations, veterans and young Americans, suicide, and the fact that the rates are elevated and going in the wrong direction generally, has served as a catalyst for the national dialogue to actually include the topic of suicide as a major public health crisis that it is. And that is unfortunately true for all age and demographic populations, almost all in the United States. Over the last between 10 and 20 years, the rate has been going up in almost every population. I think we certainly have a long way to go in sustaining the dialogue that must now move from simply a recognition of this as a public health problem to the solutions that science is providing that can actually address this issue, bend the curve, and drive down suicide rates. And that really has not happened yet, mm-hmm. to speak of. And I think that's our next big goal at AFSP, certainly.
Is getting like some implementation of measures, yes. that we know will work, that we know can help.
Exactly. I mean, it feels incredibly frustrating to know about 6 to 8 evidence-based, proven ways to reduce suicide risk that have not been implemented nearly at the rate of scale across our nation that can actually save lives and address this public health problem.
So a little bit about the Mental Health for Us campaign. How did it get started? Why 2020? Why now? How did it all come together?
You know, it's a good question. I would say that Patrick Kennedy, let's start with Patrick, he has had his own incredible personal and professional journey with regard to his own experiences of mental health conditions and addiction that he's become increasingly public about, and using his own personal experience-driven passion to drive a national dialogue around primarily policy change. You know, being a former congressman himself in Rhode Island for many years, he lives in the policy space. So I would say his own journey is a significant part of the sort of preparation and readiness to launch a very concise and sort of pointed effort, an initiative that I would say Mental Health for Us includes. And then in the national arena, what we've seen at AFSP is that stigma has been going down and the attitudes of the American adult population are opening up with regard to mental health. We think this is a major change over the last maybe 7 or 8 years. So for example, last year in a Harris poll that we sponsored with some other organizations, we found that about 90% of American adults feel that their mental health is as or more important than their physical health. They're starting to also understand that they're not the only one who thinks that way. And if you know anything about the science of change and how change happens in a community or population, that's a very important pivotal piece, that people not only believe something that is counterculture to previous beliefs, but they understand that the majority of their colleagues also feel the same way. That leads to readiness to change behavior. The time that I believe we are in right now is a time of significant transition, where the topic of mental health has sort of burst wide open, especially in the younger generation, and you see it on social media a lot, in, I would say, very positive ways, mm-hmm. about depression, anxiety, PTSD, addiction, and not just the topics, but people's personal experiences and what they're finding helps, and linking up with supportive communities. That dialogue is happening.
Kids aren't as afraid of discussing,
yes.
it and talking about it with,
yes.
each other. Yeah.
And I think that is overall a very positive thing. What has not yet happened is a translation into an actual deepening of mental health literacy, is what I would call it. A knowledge that goes beyond just an attitude of openness to an actual level of knowledge and skill around not only identifying when your mental health is deteriorating or when your loved one's is, but knowing what to do about it, both in terms of accessing treatment as well as sort of self-care strategies, or if you're the family member or loved one, supportive behaviors in the home or in the relationship that can actually help support a person's healing and improvement in their mental health. We just haven't learned how to do that. I think that's what's coming next, but we kind of have to build that. And I think, you know, Mental Health for Us is an initiative that does that at the most sort of top policy level in terms of access to treatment, knowledge about mental health conditions, prevention strategies and programs, and then an emphasis on recovery as well.
So would you say it's fair to say that all of the organizations sort of separately, one part is focusing on grassroots, is focusing on working with people, families, communities, and then coming together was maybe trying to kind of get that top-down part of the strategy and get them to meet?
Yes, most certainly. And our work in suicide prevention, and certainly at AFSP for many years now, has included what is considered a comprehensive public health strategy that does include advocacy, as you mentioned, policy change at the most sort of top-down level, but also includes grassroots and universal public education around, in our case, mental health symptoms and conditions and treatments.
So what happens after 2020? After presidential elections are done, what happens with mental health for us? What's the plan for the campaign?
Oh, I think that mental health for us will continue strong with education efforts and sort of collaborations within the policy arena, as well as with the grassroots and between our organizations to continue that important work of, you know, the way it works, I think, for most people with mental health and certainly for suicide prevention is that it's a sort of multi-step progression of learning and readiness to act in some new sort of progressive ways over time. It's rare that somebody goes, you know, sort of from 0 to 60 miles an hour in like a readiness. It's stigma related, and it's also that these are complex health issues. I think some of it too is that in the mind of the American public, there is too much of a difference placed in the tangibleness of heart disease and lung disease and kidney disease, and not understanding that that same tangible aspect is true of brain illnesses as well. And we have not understood that well. So we've thought that mental health problems come from choices and personality and character defects, and that is simply not true.
So you can learn more about the Mental Health for Us campaign at mentalhealthforus.net. It's one word, Mental Health for Us. And then also learn more about the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention at afsp.org. Thank you again, Christine, for joining us today and talking about Mental Health for Us and all that you all are doing.
Great. Thank you so much.
And thanks very much for tuning in. And yeah, we'll see you next time.